Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Juravich. After more than 30 years, the United States will be hosting FIFA's World Cup competition again, bringing together a record-breaking 48 teams to compete across the country. With games being played in stadiums from Boston to Atlanta to Kansas City and Los Angeles, all of America can celebrate and experience the tournament. But the spread-out nature of the games and other complications have some fans nervous about this year's festivities. And the World Cup isn't the only soccer news happening around town. We'll also have an update on a new coach, new coaching, and new leadership with the Columbus Crew. Longtime sports journalist Michael Ayres joins us now. He is the founder of Disrespected Media. Listeners may also know him from his years as a beat reporter and columnist with the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome to All Sides, Michael.
Oh, thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
So first off, why was America picked to host the World Cup? The last time it happened was in 1994. Do you know how it came about?
Well, it was selected because it has been described as FIFA's ATM.
Money-wise. ATM. Yeah. Got it. Money.
So
yes.
You have the U.S., Mexico, and Canada hosting, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. 11 of the cities that are host sites are in the United States, 3 in Mexico, 2 in Canada. But this is a money thing. FIFA is arguably one of the most corrupt organizations on earth. And this is their specialty is extracting money. And so they're kind of like a casino. They don't want you to leave until they have every last dime.
Yeah, yeah, we'll get to that too, because we've been talking. There's been a lot of talk about the ticket prices. But I wanted to ask you about the soccer craze, you know, here, the love of soccer in the United States and here in Columbus. How much has it grown since 1994, the last time we hosted the World Cup?
Well, quite a bit. The 1994 World Cup, part of the deal with the U.S. hosting was that a top-tier soccer league, professional soccer league, would be established. Mm. And that's when MLS came online in 1996. It's a direct result of the awarding of the United States with the World Cup in 1994. And since then, I mean, there's lots of ways you can measure it. You can say someone of my generation played Little League Baseball. Someone raising children now is shuttling to soccer practice.
I was at a soccer field last night.
Yeah.
Yes.
So when did soccer mom come into our lexicon? I mean, all that is part of the arc of the growth of the game in the United States. You can measure it by numbers. If you take a look at the Crew, it cost $5 million to buy into the league in 1996. The league almost went under in 2000, 2001, somewhere in there. This Crew sold for $67.5 million in 2014, which was then a record. The Haslam family and the Edwards family paid $150 million to keep the team here in 2018, 2019. And the team's been valued at around $900 million now. So,
oh boy. Okay.
That'll give you a monetary idea of the arc of the growth of the game in the United States.
From $5 million to $900 million? Wow.
That's right. Yeah.
Wow.
In that span of time.
So although Columbus is not officially hosting tournament matches, the city is involved in the World Cup festivities. I read that there's the international base camp here, citywide watch parties, but also we're doing a pre-tournament friendly match. So tell me, what is a pre-tournament friendly match mean?
Well, what's pretty cool is, and this is where if you're a disgruntled U.S. soccer fan, let's say, and you're looking for another team, here in Columbus, Ecuador has its base camp. In fact, they opened it today. Mm. So they'll be training here and then flying off to play their games, their group stage games in different parts of the country, 3 group stage games. So in between, they train, and ahead of the beginning of the official competition, they're having what soccer people call a friendly, what we would know as an exhibition game. So they're going to play Guatemala in the new Crew Stadium on June 7th, 4 o'clock. compared to the rest of the World Cup, and again, this is just a practice game, but tickets are fairly reasonable. Most of them are under $100.
Under $100? Yeah. Okay.
That's what passes for reasonable.
I think that passes for reasonable right now. But so the fact that Ecuador has chosen Columbus for its base camp, I mean, I guess does every team needs a base camp because the World Cup goes on for so many weeks. They need to be here training here, right?
Right. Because it's if you're there to the end, it's 2 months. Mm-hmm. I forget how deep the group stage goes, but a few weeks anyway. So, mm-hmm. Ecuador scouted and they landed on Columbus for a lot of reasons. I mean, it's a beautiful facility they have over there, all their training grounds, et cetera. It's also
like at the old Crew Stadium. Yeah, that's exactly where they're going to train. Yeah, mm-hmm.
Exactly. And you know, there's been other teams that have stayed there too, national teams and such.
And so that's the pre-tournament friendly match, and then Ecuador having its base camp here, and then the city's hosting watch parties throughout, right? Is that another thing that Columbus is trying to do to kind of lean into the hype?
Yeah, once again, it's everyone's looking for their little corner of this business, and
yeah.
I am too. I mean, I'm planning or in conversations with people to do live events at this bar or that bar. We'll see how it goes. But yeah, it's part and parcel of thing. I think people in Columbus will remember going back years. Maybe it was in the aughts, the watch parties at the old Crew Stadium. And mm-hmm. That was pretty cool. Now it's more dispersed, I guess. Every bar, there's a lot of soccer bars in Columbus now that are affiliated with different teams. And a lot of them are also affiliated with the U.S. national mm-hmm. team.
So for the whole World Cup, are you planning on traveling to any games, or are you going to watch from home?
Oh, Amy, the budget's not quite there yet.
Yeah.
But if you'd like to go to the disrespected.com and leave me $10,000, I'd gladly go on the round.
Give me a minute. I'll get there. Yeah. Okay. So you plan on, you know, watching a lot of the games from home and following. I mean, are you following, like, who are the biggest teams? Like, what team are we keeping an eye out to make it through?
Well, am I following? Yes and no. Mm-hmm. I'm probably among that cadre of U.S. soccer fans that is so disgusted by the lead up to this World Cup and also the political interconnections with this World Cup that it's been a big turnoff for me. But of course, this is, as John Oliver had a tremendous rant many years ago about how, for a lot of people all over the world, this is the most delicious thing. It's the biggest event. The World Cup is the ultimate sausage. The problem is what the sausage is made out of. There's a lot of scraps from the floor that go into the casing. So will I be watching? Yeah, I'll be watching. You know, you can't help it. And again, I hope to meet with the people who've been supporting me at this place or another and doing some live podcasts. Mm-hmm.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the World Cup with Michael Ayres, longtime sports journalist and founder of Disrespected Media. So I want to pause our World Cup talk for a few minutes because there's been some big news with our team here, the Columbus Crew. The head coach has been fired. What did you think about this? I mean, there's been a rocky start to the season, and now Hendrik Rystrom has been fired. What do you make of that?
Well, what I wrote more than once at the disrespected.com was that I thought he got done dirty. I didn't like that, you know, our local MLS affiliate went through a long process to hire this guy, brought him over from Sweden. This is a man with a high profile in Europe and had his pick of European jobs that were open at the time. They get him here. They look at him for 136 days. He wins 3 of 14 league matches, and they decide that what he's doing is not going to work and doesn't fit their eye. And you know what? There were some other things going on behind the scenes, but that just didn't feel right to me. I thought the man got done wrong. That said, you can argue also that the general manager, Issa Tall, recognized problems, some that we weren't privy to see, mm-hmm. obviously. There's always more going on than we realize. One of the assistant coaches was problematic. I've heard a lot of things, but you can say that Issa Tall made a mistake by hiring this guy who didn't fit what they wanted, or you could say he did the right thing by cutting bait as soon as possible with a machete. So certainly the the rebound off that, Laurent Courtois comes in with two games prior to the World Cup break, one a U.S. Open Cup game and the other the last MLS game prior to the two-month break, and post two shutouts. And all the players are happy now. They're all happy.
Everyone likes
they
to win.
Happy, yeah. Amy, and now they're much happier.
So are they going to stick with this interim coach, or do you know who they're eyeing for a replacement?
That was one of the first questions I put to Issa Tall, the general manager, after he made this move. And what he said was that Laurent Courtois, who has been in the Crew system, had a hiatus where he coached in Montreal for a year before he got fired, came back. So he's familiar with Papa Wilfried Nancy's system and his style of coaching, which is why he has a comfort level with the players. And so given all of this and the fact that they believe he's a promising coach and he has some bona fides on his CV, that he's going to get to beyond the World Cup break. So he'll get a transfer window to toy with the roster, with the general manager, and with Tim Bezpachenko, who's coming home from Europe.
All right, we'll get to Tim in 1 second. But what you mentioned the old coach, Coach Nancy. What about bringing him back? Is he available? Right? He's available, right? You talked about getting done dirty. He the same thing happened to him. He didn't coach very long in his new gig.
I think they have Wilfried Nancy light. Is it possible there'll be a Nancy 2.0? It's possible. There's nothing that I've heard that would lead me to believe that's going to happen. I think Wilfried has his eye on Europe. You know, he had one kick at the can at an impossible place, Celtic in Glasgow, in the Scottish Premiership. I think what we'll see is as Tim Bezpachenko steps into the role of president of global soccer, I think, or whatever the title is. There's global in the title, I know that. I think you'll see, as most insanely wealthy people who own sports teams do, Haslam Sports Group will make a foray into Europe. And if they do, Tim Bezpachenko will be spearheading it, and he'll have a favored coach. That's the way I view that.
Okay, so Tim Bezpachenko is returning to Ohio. The former Crew general manager will be the Haslam Sports Group's new. The title is President of Global Soccer. What is this title all about? What is this?
Well, Tim Bezpachenko built the Crew for their glory era of Wilfried Nancy, which was Tim Bezpachenko is probably the most brilliant soccer executive in the United States, and he's still only like 44 years old.
Okay.
But when the Crew was saved, the Haslam and Edwards families, and I think the Edwards family might have had more to do with it, brought him to Columbus. He's from Columbus. His family was lifelong Crew season ticket holders. He had worked in the league office and prior to that for a white shoe law firm in New York City. He had built a Toronto team that was one of the greatest teams to that point in league history, won an MLS Cup and a few Canadian titles. And when the Crew was saved, he came home to Columbus. He went to DeSales High School, and he's from Westerville. He came home, and as soon as he could, he hired Wilfried Nancy. It took too long, but hired Wilfried Nancy. And so Cup in 2020 with Caleb Porter, MLS Cup again in 2023 with Wilfried Nancy, a Leagues Cup in 2024, and at one juncture there in the summer of 2024, the Columbus Crew were the highest-ranked club team on the continent, in CONCACAF. So he built the best team in North America and then left to take a job overseeing Bill Foley. He's the Vegas Golden Knights owner. He has a portfolio of teams in Europe. Bezpachenko for the last 2 years has overseen that. Contract up, things change in Columbus. The Haslam Sports Group lands an expansion bid for the NWSL. So their portfolio is growing, and obviously they have ambitions in Europe. So Tim Bezpachenko comes home to build another practice facility, build another coaching staff, another franchise, oversee the Crew at the same time, and with an eye toward expansion into Europe.
So part of his job is going to be to oversee this expansion and this women's team that we're getting.
Right, and that's part of the timing of all of this. They always needed Tim Bezpachenko. It was awful when he left. In fact, you can, with Wilfried Nancy and anything else, but you can see the point of where Tim Bezpachenko left and a downward line in the fortunes of the Crew. Fans love him. for obvious reasons. He's brilliant. He's a wonderful guy. He's from Columbus.
And he's a winner.
Yeah, a hometown winner.
Yeah.
That's right.
All right. So what are his prospects with building this women's team? What do you think is going to happen here?
Well, we'll see. Obviously, the franchise, the 18th franchise in NWSL, was just awarded. Mm-hmm. They stole a park on the southwest side to
Yeah, we did a whole show about that park. Yeah.
That was
something.
You know, I always come back to it. People want the women's team here for a host of reasons we could get into. But did you have to take the park to get the deal done? I mean, that's what bothered me about it. Now, I applaud Shannon Harden for getting concessions, afterwards or during the process. And we'll see if the people of the southwest side will be well served in the aftermath. That remains to be seen. But that part of it is, do you have to have everything? That's what's bothersome. And that's what the World Cup theme is. We have to have everything.
Mm.
All your money.
All right. Well, let's take a break, and then we'll talk more about the World Cup taking all of our money. Staying with us is Michael Ares, longtime sports journalist and founder of Disrespected Media. Coming up, we will talk more about the World Cup and all that money. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
You know, every day on Up First, NPR's Golden Globe-nominated morning news podcast, we bring you three essential stories. At the heart of each story are questions. What really happened? What really mattered? What happens next? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious and to follow the facts. Follow Up First wherever you get your podcasts and start your day knowing what matters and why.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Every 4 years, the festivities of the World Cup bring the world together, celebrating soccer played by countries from around the world. However, many fans are reporting problems, like transportation issues, sky-high ticket and hotel pricing, and fan events not having enough security. Are all these anxieties brewing at a time before the games start, and are they going to continue and be present for the entire tournament? We're talking with longtime sports journalist and founder of Disrespected Media, Michael Ares. Thanks for joining us, Michael.
Oh, again, it's wonderful to be here.
All right, so let's talk about those sky-high ticket prices, because I know people who found out where the venues are. You know, there's 11 venues in the United States. They picked one, they got the hotel, they got the Airbnb, and then ticket prices came out, and they said, oh no, we can't go to the game.
Well, as I said before, FIFA's specialty is taking all your money. You know, they're like the world's largest casino in a way. Well, they take something that the world loves, and they monetize it to the nth degree. In fact, their effort for this World Cup was known as something like maximum revenue something. So it's the largest World Cup. They expanded to 48 teams, as you mentioned. So it's got another knockout round. There's all these venues, and it's in, you know, the richest economy in the world. So FIFA's going big. Mm-hmm. So where they'll use slave labor to build stadiums in Qatar, here they're just going to go for maximum profits. That's how they'll boost the bottom line. But yeah, the ticket prices are 320% over Qatar in 2022. That's a 320% raise. I just looked up last night the latest real-time prices across all 104 matches. Average starting price, $581. Average ticket price, $1,266. Total tickets still available, a million plus.
So a million tickets still left, but at $1,200 each, that is a lot of money to take you if you want to take your kid.
It could be a problem, because as we sit here now, the last figures I saw is SoFi Stadium in LA, where the U.S. will play Paraguay in their first game of the group stage. I think they'd sold something just north of 40,000 tickets for the USA's first match, which should be one of the premier matches of the group
stage.
It should
be sold out, yeah.
Right, and that place holds like 70,000. So, yeah, demand is falling a little bit, and we're seeing some corrections in the market. You know, there's also some neat things being done by city organizers, like local organizers, like the Philadelphia Committee in Atlanta in particular. Whereas in New York, they're jacking up transportation costs to a, you know, exponential factor. You know, in places, in Philly, for instance, they're saying, no, it's $2.90, not $200 to get to the game and back. So there's been some backlash, and there's some correcting in the market, and we'll see things how things look in a week, and then 2 weeks and 3 weeks.
Yeah, you mentioned dynamic pricing. So if that game that you, the example you gave, the opening match for USA in LA, if it doesn't sell out, I mean, are you going to see like the day before tickets are going to be reasonable, like normal soccer prices?
Well, I think it'd be something's going to happen, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
they have to fill it, right?
I mean, you don't want to come online on television with the world's largest sporting event, and here's the host country, a
half
host
empty,
country,
yeah,
and a thing that's a quarter empty. Yeah, that wouldn't be a good look.
All right.
If you like this shot where they, you know, they have to put the curtains over the top boulder. You know?
Oh, see, then that would just be sad.
I'm not supposed to say that, right?
Right.
Here at WOSU.
Oh, that's okay. I don't mind. So one of the biggest concerns for many tourists is it has some Americans being worried, is the lack of public transportation in this country, because fans are coming from Europe and Asia and even South America, where cities there have massive transit systems. I mean, they have good transit. So do you think that fans coming here from other countries are going to be able to get around?
Well, I think they'll be able to get around. Again, all of these things were tended to in the preparation in every city. There are committees of people that are supposed to set all this up. I think the problem is, again, we're back to what some cities are doing in terms of pricing. We're not hearing any problems, though, I guess, to speak directly to your question, in places like Vancouver and Mexico City, right?
Right, right. So there's there's 11 cities, though, in the U.S.
United States,
yeah. So as an example, like Gillette Stadium is hosting a quarterfinal match, and it's a 40-minute drive from the Boston airport with no traffic. So do you think a city like Boston is going to be able to get the people where they need to go?
One thing I read recently, and I won't swear to this, but from what I read, that is one of the round trips that they're trying to hold the prices down, that they're actually holding the line, and they're not gouging people. You know, Boston, Philly, and Atlanta are being reasonable, and of course, they don't have the marquee games really either, or they don't have the bulk of the marquee games in the group stage. So
now, I don't remember the World Cup in 1994 very well. Was it spread out like this in 11 different cities?
Geez, that's a good question. Yeah. I just remember the opening ceremonies in Chicago, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
That was the day of the OJ chase.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's a memorable day. All right. 1994, a big year.
Yeah, I was, you know, that night I was at Madison Square Garden covering a Knicks Houston Rockets NBA Finals game 5. And there was actually that morning, there's a great documentary on ESPN, the 30 for 30, about that very date, June, whatever it was, 1994, June 7th, something like that. And that morning there was also the Rangers had won the Stanley Cup. So I was in New York during the Rangers victory parade, and then that night it was game 5 of the NBA finals, and obviously there's no phones then in your hands, and I was in an auxiliary press box, and the game stopped because the game was eerie, because like Bob Costas is cutting to the OJ car chase, fans were going out into the concourses to watch the car chase on TV
instead of the game.
Yeah, and they were leaning over my shoulder in the press box, trying to see what was going on with the OJ chase. But sorry, I didn't quite answer your question there, Amy.
All right, so
what
we
was
don't.
Your question again?
It was the World Cup in '94.
How dispersed was it?
Yeah, was it in 11 cities?
Man, look at all the homework I did. I wasn't ready for that one.
All right, that's okay. That's okay. Maybe. Okay. Wait, you know, my producer Aaron Rabinowitz says it was 9 venues throughout the U.S. in 1994. So still probably spread out, not as many as 11, but 9.
Yeah. It generally is. I mean, if you think back to, well, Brazil, for instance, they were building stadiums and promising urban renewal in the Amazon, you know. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, these things are...
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the World Cup with Michael Ares, longtime sports journalist and founder of Disrespected Media. So from your perspective, the complaints about the ticket prices, is it also going to be an economic boost for the cities, though? Or does FIFA keep all that money? Like, do the cities that are hosting, you know, win from some of this?
Oh, I'm sure they do. Mm-hmm. Just as on a smaller scale, say, when the Memorial Tournament rolls into Columbus once mm-hmm. a year, there is an economic ripple, like with any other sporting events. Whether you love or hate the Arnold, a lot of people come to Columbus and mm-hmm. spend their money in hotels and restaurants, etc. So yeah, there are certainly those ripple effects. There will be economic benefits to these cities, depending on what the drawbacks are. I don't know how it'll balance out, but Sure.
So from your perspective, what are some of the biggest complaints and concerns you're hearing from fans besides the ticket prices? Are you hearing anything else that people are worried about?
I think that from what I hear, it speaks to what you would see generally scripted now as the problems that are cropping up. You've mentioned them here and there. But first of all, I mean, we're at war with Iran. Iran's in the World Cup. The United States won't let them stay in the United States. They're in Mexico, and they come to the U.S. play. They're going to play their three group stage games, and then they have to go. They have to commute from Mexico City for the World Cup. Mm. But there's obviously that's the war, the politics, the ticket prices, the gouging. FIFA's greed, which has long been naked, and you know how demand is trailing off. I just think that a lot of people were turned off before the U.S. team was even announced yesterday. You know, then again, it's that delicious sausage, and like you know, even for fans around here, Ecuador's in town. That could be cool. You know, you have Max Arfston is a crew player. He was named to Team USA. Stephen Moreira, Cape Verde. It's a wonderful story. It's 10 small islands off the west coast mm-hmm. of Africa, and they somehow made the World Cup. Curaçao is even smaller, and they made the World Cup. Seb Berhalter, the son of the former crew and U.S. men's national team coach, might start for Team USA, and he came up through the crew system. There's a lot of things even for local fans to kind of hang their hats on, and you know, once you start setting up best on best competitions, country v country, there's terrific power in that, and this is the world's sport. This is what people love.
Besides trying to go see Team USA play, are the most popular games the ones where you're like what Ronaldo's in, whatever game
well,
he happens to
and
play?
Then, you know, yeah. Other storylines, you got Lionel yeah. Messi and Ronaldo playing in their whatever sixth World Cups.
They're going to face each other.
I'm not sure. I have to look at the groups here.
That's okay.
Well, USA is in Group D, which people have been jokingly called the group of life because they should get out of there. And if the U.S. doesn't get out of a group with Paraguay, Australia, and Turkey.
We have no business playing soccer.
Yeah, exactly. they should go try and win the World Baseball Classic again, you know. Mm. And then the group of death, which is generally speaking, but not necessarily, it's generally the group with the highest concentration of high-ranked teams in it. And this year it's Group I. France is right now the number one ranked team in the world. Mm. Senegal's 14, Norway 29, and Iraq 57. That is probably the group of death. So those teams, you know, France is one, Spain is two, Argentina is three in the world, and they're the defending champions. England, which is still trying to win. When was the last time? It was the 60s. Portugal's five and Ronaldo's playing for them, Messi's playing for Argentina. There's always all kinds of storylines, and there's, as you know, there's 100 things that are going to come up that
in the moment. Yeah. So will this be, though, just due to age, in theory, this could be Ronaldo and Messi's last World Cup?
Oh yeah, I would hope
it would
so.
It would be shocking if they were playing again 4 years from now, right?
Yeah, I mean, maybe I don't know how fast and nimble motorized wheelchairs can be, but I would hope this would be their
life. So if you want to see them play, this is your chance to see them, you know, here in the U.S.
Right.
And, yeah.
Right. And we'll see how it goes as a TV event. I don't know. I'm looking forward to being with people at events. I mean, that's all part and parcel of this. But as far as like camping out on my couch and just rolling through World Cup games, I'm not doing that.
Are you hearing anything? I asked you what you're hearing about concerns, complaints from fans. Are you hearing any concerns, complaints from coaching staff or players? Are they just excited to come to America, or are they worried about anything too?
Not explicitly, you know. Again, the United States is, how shall we say, it's not held in the same regard as it was, I don't know, pick a year, Amy.
1994.
That's a good year.
Yeah.
This is a different place. Different things have gone on geopolitically. And so that is certainly a factor. Mm-hmm. You throw in the fact that since the war began in Iran, what is it, about 90 days ago now or something like that, if you take into account fuel prices and what fans are, you know, it's take into account, you know, inflation and cost of fuel, travel and et cetera. It has a much bigger inflection on it than it did, you know, 6 months ago.
If you were to bet on one city to deliver the most traditional World Cup atmosphere, do you know which city is going to bring it home for soccer here in the U.S.?
Well, you know, New York is a great soccer city. You know, there's I know a lot of people that take soccer trips to New York. Let's pop in for a weekend Airbnb and then hit a bar where the Liverpool fans are at 6 o'clock on Sunday morning.
Mm-hmm.
And there's bars like that. And most big cities are like that. Chicago's like that, so forth. But the thing about New York is L.A. is the same kind of deal with Inglewood. But, you know, MetLife Stadium in East Rutherford is not New York City. You know what I mean?
That's very true, yeah.
No, I think you're going to see, especially when you consider how MLS has grown, there's a more commonality to soccer fans. There's more of them, and that stuff's going to be great. As I'm coming back to it again, I'm more looking forward to hanging out with people in a bar and podcasting than I am to maybe any actual games.
All right. Well, you can stay tuned to what Michael Arias comes up with podcasting and watch parties at Disrespected Media. I want to thank you for joining us. We've been talking with Michael Arias, longtime sports journalist and founder of Disrespected Media. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Amy. And please go to thedisrespected.com and donate money to my travel budget.
The travel budget. Yeah. So you can go see one of these games. Well, coming up, we're going to talk more about the World Cup and just the future of soccer in general in the United States. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Soccer has always lived in the shadows of bigger sports in the United States, like American football and basketball. But over the last decade, the number of soccer fans in the U.S. has skyrocketed, particularly leading up to this year's World Cup, taking place right here in America. What problems are fans across the country going to face this World Cup season, and how are teams going to capitalize on the new environment of this sport? Joining us now is Ryan Chen, Assistant Professor of Sports Leadership and Management at Miami University. His focus is on satellite sports fandom, sports technology, and digital consumption of sports. Welcome to the show, Ryan.
Thank you for having me here.
So what are your initial thoughts going into this year's World Cup? How do you think the United States is going to do as a host?
Well, I mean, we're all waiting for this opportunity, right? Because it's been, for soccer fans like me, it's been way too long, probably four years of waiting. And we're hoping that the United States would, you know, at least try their best as they can, and then trying to advance to the later, you know, stages in the tournament. And with our new coaches, well, not technically new, but with our world famous coach and also our great players in Europe, playing in the Europe top leagues, we're hoping that the United States is going to do great in the tournament this year.
Do you think that the way we host in our 11 cities that we have here is going to be a significant departure from the way it's been done at past World Cups?
Well, I think this can be seen from two kind of ways. First, this has been the way that, you know, a mega sport event like the Men's World Cup has been held over the past 20 years has been pretty consistent. I would say it's pretty standardized, not just in the United States, but also in Qatar, in Brazil, in even in Russia. So on that case, that's pretty much consistent. But on the other hand, in this tournament, we've seen a lot of the new things, especially for FIFA as the organizing, the governing body of soccer internationally. We've seen a lot of the new, you know, commercialized opportunities and the practices that's been done by the organization trying to monetize the tournament a little bit more compared to what happened in the past 20 years.
Yeah. So when you say monetize the tournament, our previous guest said it was basically FIFA's stealing all our money. So, yeah. So, I mean, you're saying it in a more diplomatic way, but the pricing has made fans very wary of this World Cup experience. Prices, are they significantly different than previous World Cups? Do you know?
Yes, I think that's something I have to be honest, because the prices are really different, especially compared to the previous tournaments. I know that in Qatar 2022, everybody was talking about how cheap they can get in the stadiums, trying to purchase the not just the group stage, but also the knockout stage games. But this time, we've seen from the official data, the tickets has been skyrocket, you know, to a large kind of the extent. So that's true.
Do you feel like the ticket prices are going to have to come down because America can't put these games on TV with the stadium half empty?
Yes, I would definitely hope so. But I don't know, to be honest, because there's still kind of like 2 weeks from now. And then, as we probably all know, that the organization of FIFA, actually, they start doing the dynamic pricing for this tournament. So it's all depending on the market demand of the tickets. Mm-hmm. Right now, I also, just before this show, I did a quick kind of search on the price tickets, the price, and then it's been becoming still kind of really high at this moment, definitely higher than the official price range given by FIFA. So I'm not sure, but I'm definitely hoping. Mm.
Can you talk about how the United States views soccer, or football, as I should probably call it, but how does the United States view soccer? How has it changed from when we hosted the World Cup in 1994 to where we are now?
Well, I think a lot of things have changed. Well, in 1994, we would all probably agree that soccer is pretty much still, the United States is still pretty much a soccer desert. So there's, you know, little interest. A lot of interest still coming from the big four sport tournaments or the leagues here. So I think in 1994, everything about that tournament is about how do you build that culture? You know, how are you trying to attract more fans? How are you going to, you know, trying to attract fans to gain their interest into the sport of soccer? But right now, since 1994, it's been almost 30 years, And then even in I think in the past, 10 years, soccer culture has become really prominent in the country. Now we don't just watch, the big four leagues in North America. We watch the English Premier Leagues. Yeah, on ESPN, we have all the European major leagues broadcasted regularly over the weekend. And then there are a lot of the interest from the grassroots, from the people who are really interested in seeing the soccer games these days. So right now, I think, the culture has been pretty mature compared to 30 years ago. And then there is definitely a lot of the interest coming from people
If
in the
we were,
country.
yeah, if we were trying to grow soccer's American interest 30 years ago in 1994, I bet the ticket prices were a little more reasonable, right? So you could take your kids.
Yes.
Yes. One of the focuses in your area of study, Professor Chen, is called satellite sports fandom. And correct me if I'm explaining this incorrectly, but satellite sports fandom is when you don't live in the city with your team anymore, but you still follow them. Is that right?
Right. In a more precise way, we're not living in the kind of like the local proximity or the cultural proximity to the team that we're following.
Yeah. So tell me about that with soccer, because I know a lot of people just anecdotally in my life who love to follow just whatever team Ronaldo's playing for, whatever team Messi's playing for. So they have this affinity and I guess they're a satellite sports fan, right? Because they'll follow that team.
Yes.
Talk to me about how that's happened in soccer, for the past few years.
Well, so in the United States in particular, we have a lot of these, satellite soccer fans who are just like you said, trying to follow the stars, follow the big teams, especially in probably like Spain or England. And the way this is working, I think it definitely has a lot to do with the media companies in the United States, because just take NBC as a case. The NBC in the United States, they have the broadcasting rights for the English Premier League in the United States. And then in addition to all the shows they're hosting for every weekend, for every game week of the league, they also regularly host those in-person events around the country. I think in Chicago, in Tampa, in Orlando, I'm seeing a lot of those cases where they actually put a studio in those cities. So they have those live events as the game goes on. And then there are a lot of fans who are trying to attend those, the in-person events. And then everybody's just trying to enjoy the game, not just, watching the TV in their home, but enjoying the game with some of the other fans from the nation. And then I think that is, definitely helping with the boost of the fandom of, soccer in the United States.
Do you predict, with this World Cup, you're going to see a lot of those satellite sports fans? This is their only chance to see that team in person without having to travel to Europe or South America. So they're going to definitely try, despite the prices, to get to that game.
I would say probably if you're talking about from the national teams kind of standpoint, I would say probably this is the best chance, because this is the event that every the best na national teams of soccer would compete in the country. But if we're talking about the general like soccer stars, the celebrity players, or those things, I would not think this is the only opportunity for fans to see, because as we probably notice, right now, more and more European soccer teams, there's shifting their focus to the United States. So a lot of teams have spent their summer doing the tours, the business tours, the friendly games in the nation. So there are a lot of the opportunities for fans to see those players if they wanted to, follow them.
Yeah, so yes, that's true. A lot of soccer teams are having friendly games here, bringing it to America. And then America's doing the same thing. We're taking American football over to Europe and trying to expose them to that. So how do you think that's going to go if you had to predict, will Europe pick up football, American football?
Yeah, well, I mean, I actually am pretty surprised to see that, right now, a lot of Europeans are having a lot of strong interest in American sport products. We've seen, you know, people wearing NBA jerseys on the streets. We've also seen, especially in Germany, I think a lot of people in Germany, especially the young generations, they have a strong interest in the, especially the NFL and the NBA. So I think, like you said, there is a lot of, you know, the communications or the exchanges of the sporting culture, you know, in between Europe and the United States, which is really, you know, interesting too.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the World Cup with Ryan Chen, Assistant Professor of Sports Leadership and Management at Miami University. I wanted to talk to you a little bit more about your other area of study, which is the digital consumption of sport. So you mentioned that NBC is the host of a lot of these games. You can watch them on TV. How do they do with, like, you know, the app and showing all the games? I mean, is it expensive? Are people buying into this to be able to watch all the soccer all the time?
Well, I think that also has a lot to do with the, you know, the existing structure of the TV rights in the United States. Mm-hmm. Because as a soccer fan myself, I'm also hoping that there is a consistent platform that, you know, I can just purchase that platform and I can watch all the English Premier Leagues at the one time. But unfortunately, that's not how the things is working in this country. So for the NBC, I think for the English Premier League, you have, you know, the TV rights, which they divided all the games into two platforms. One is through the cable networks. And then the other part is through their, you know, digital mobile app or the app called, you know, Peacock. So if you subscribe to Peacock, it's actually relatively cheaper because you only have to, I think, only have to pay like $8 or $9 to subscribe to that, you know, that app. And then you can watch half of the games for the English Premier League. But for the other half of the games, especially for those, you know, the blockbuster games of each week, you actually have to, you know, subscribe to the cable TV in order to watch it. Mm. So on that case, it's creating a lot of the hurdles for, you know, the spectators to enjoy the games.
Well, and you're going to expose my lack of World Cup knowledge, but how many different apps do I need to watch all the World Cup games?
I think for the World Cup, it's actually a little bit easier. Especially now. You don't have to worry too much about just like, you know, you, now you have to subscribe probably 10 services to watch the NBA these days. Mm-hmm. The World Cup is, I think it's going to be pretty similar to, especially to the last World Cup in Qatar, which is pretty consistent. You don't have to you know, pay too much service. But the price for subscribing might be a little bit higher compared to the service like Peacock or, you know, ESPN Plus or something.
So we'll treat the World Cup more like the Olympics, because you could see
yes,
most of the Olympics things, because it only comes around once every 4 years. So there's more access to it. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct.
One last thing I wanted to ask you about is the classic events of the World Cup, the fan festivals. You said you're a big soccer fan. Can you tell me a little bit more about, you know, the fan festivals and what America can gain from hosting a good one?
The World Cup is definitely, you know, a fan festival for all the soccer, not just the soccer fans, but all fans. Well, because before the game, there's going to be, you know, we're all, you know, very used to this, because there's always going to be the tailgating stuff before a big game. And that is the same thing for the World Cup. So in person, if you are living in that city, there's going to be a huge watch party outside of the stadium, outside of the venue. But at the same time, I also think, especially for the TV broadcasters, there will be a lot of, you know, the shows that's going to be about that team and also that culture behind that team. So I think there's going to be a lot of the opportunities, just like the Olympic game, that we're going to be knowing a lot of the different teams, different players, different cultures behind these teams. So which is really going to be leading to a huge fan, you know, festival in this country for the people here.
And just to end on, if you can predict, do you think most of these games are going to be full of American fans watching soccer, or are you expecting a lot of people traveling from a lot of different countries and coming here?
I think there is definitely going to be a lot of international travelers because this is a part of the, you know, the international soccer culture. There's, you know, the fans from Brazil who is going to attend the games, no matter how pricey, how far it is, they're going to go to the, you know, go to every World Cup games that, you know, their country is playing every time, probably five, six times in a row. So there's definitely going to be a lot of the travelers from all over the world, which is going to be really fun. But at the same time, I also think there's probably going to be the majority of the fans coming from the United States, because this is the opportunity for us to enjoy the game, to enjoy, you know, the culture of soccer and all the great players here.
We've been talking about soccer fans at the upcoming World Cup, hosted mostly in the U.S., but also in Canada and Mexico, with Ryan Chen, Assistant Professor of Sports Leadership and Management at Miami University. Thank you so much for your time today, Ryan.
Thank you.
And you're listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich. Thanks for joining us.
You know, every day on Up First, NPR's Golden Globe-nominated morning news podcast, we bring you three essential stories. At the heart of each story are questions. What really happened? What really mattered? What happens next? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious and to follow the facts. Follow Up First wherever you get your podcasts and start your day knowing what matters and why.